Should you use YouTube as a source of information on the pandemic?
Does hydroxychloroquine help individuals with COVID infection?
When people come to the hospital, can we predict who's going to have a bad outcome?
And using a smartphone application to predict potential COVID-infected patients.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to the BMJ Global Health, the British Medical Journal, a look at YouTube as a source of information on COVID-19. They query this with a pandemic of misinformation. People turn, of course, to the internet for all kinds of medical information, YouTube being a very popular platform. In this study, what they did is look at 150 videos. They chose 69 of those, so 46%. In their analysis, and that totaled 257 million plus views. And they found that of that, just about 28% of those videos contained non-factual information, and that was responsible for over 62 million views in total. They divided all of these videos into, well, all right, who's making these things and are they reputable sources or not reputable sources, government or whatever. And they also took a look at this in comparison to previous YouTube studies during the Ebola, Zika, and H1N1 pandemics to see how they compared. It turns out that there's some objective ways of evaluating the information that's on videos, and these are something that's called DISCERN and the modified JAMA scores, as well as a novel COVID-19 specific score. So they attempted to try to use these to look at the content that was in these videos. And of course, it's very disturbing that there's a tremendous number of them out there, just about a quarter of them containing things that were not accurate or assertions that were deleterious. For example, some of them contained racist remarks about the Chinese, for example. There were conspiracy theories that were put forward, and there were statements related to attempts to cure the viral infection. I'm not exactly sure what we can do about this, but it certainly is a concern.
One of the things that we can do, as you mentioned, videos that were more likely to give misinformation or non-factual information were those that were most likely made from individuals. Oftentimes, they originated from internet sources and were less likely to be from government sources or from organizations that have expertise like the WHO or CDC. So one of the things that YouTube needs to do is they need to align with the government and organizations that provide factual information to make sure these are more representative, because as they looked at the number of videos, those particular videos were actually underrepresented. Focusing on those that are factual, bringing those to the forefront, an easy solution.
I think it sounds like a really easy solution, and then I would point to both Twitter and Facebook and the difficulties that they've both had in trying to get their arms around misinformation, things that are directive to people that turn out to not be good societally. They've had a lot of trouble with that, and I suspect the same thing is true with YouTube.
Elizabeth, as you know, my son works for Facebook, and he's in the area that looks at risk mitigation. And these are specific things we're trying to target. In other words, if there's misinformation and they can identify it, get it off as quickly as possible. You'd like to be able to do that with AI or with some screening mechanism that doesn't involve someone to actually view it. But they actually have people that sit and view these to say, gosh, if it's racist, if it's discriminatory, if it proposes things of that nature, it's taken off. The difficulty is identifying as quickly as possible before other people view it.
Well, that's right, because then once somebody copies it, then it's really challenging to try to get rid of it after that. Talking about misinformation then, why don't we turn to JAMA and let's look at the study that these highly touted therapies, how did they really turn out?
And specifically, we're talking about the use of hydroxychloroquine, with or without the use of azithromycin, an antibiotic. As many individuals know, this was touted as a possible treatment for COVID-infected patients on the basis of really some very scant observational data and some in vitro data. If you go back to previous viral infections, hydroxychloroquine was not particularly beneficial. So this is actually a very good analysis. It's a retrospective multicenter cohort study of individuals with COVID-19 in New York State. Over 1,400 hospitalized patients with a proven diagnosis of COVID-19. Some of those individuals were treated with hydroxychloroquine with or without azithromycin, and some were not. And they ask a simple question: what is the overall hospital mortality between those that received treatment with hydroxychloroquine with or without azithromycin versus those that did not receive it? And ultimately, what they found out is that the hydroxychloroquine, either with or without azithromycin, did not improve overall mortality. It didn't make it any worse necessarily, but it certainly didn't make it any better. Unfortunately, it's not a randomized control trial. It is an observational trial. Nevertheless, this is one of many studies that have put a dagger in the heart of hydroxychloroquine therapy. I think that the evidence is pretty clear, no benefit.
What about side effects of treatment?
Those that received hydroxychloroquine with azithromycin had a twofold increased incidence of cardiac arrest, most likely associated with cardiac arrhythmias.
Well, so we're not going to be using that. And let's hope that as remdesivir use ramps up all over the country and all over the world, we're not going to pan that treatment next time. Let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. This was a study that I served up as when people come into the hospital presenting with COVID-19 infection. How can we predict if they're at risk for a poor outcome? This is a cohort study of almost 1,600 patients from China. Their mean age was just about 49 years, and of that number, 57% about were men. They took a look at 72 potential predictors of what might say this person is at risk, and they ultimately came up with 10 variables. And I'm going to name them all because I think they're really important, and also remind folks that they can go online and they can see this list so that they can use it in their own hospitals if they'd like to raise their level of suspicion and maybe put people in a place where they're going to be increasingly scrutinized. Clearly, some of these things we probably knew already. Chest radiographic abnormalities, of course, age, whether they're coughing up blood, shortness of breath, unconsciousness, the number of comorbidities. Then three that were novel to me: neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, lactate dehydrogenase level, and direct bilirubin. And when you put all those together, they had a predictive score that could say this person is at risk for a bad outcome.
These 10 variables that you mentioned were all things that were assessed when the patient was admitted. And they helped decide, does the patient experience one of three critically ill events? One is, do they end up in the ICU? Second, do they end up on a ventilator? Or third, do they die? This risk score, or these 10 things, predicted who was likely to be in that high-risk category. Now, only about 12% of patients hospitalized end up in that very highest risk. And so you like to be able to identify them early on. And these risk factors do it. Now, the nice thing is that you can go online and actually enter these, and it will give you a percentage. For example, people in the low risk category, their chance of having one of these events is less than 1%. If you're in the high risk category, it's closer to 60%. And so this is an application that's available to any healthcare provider who's taking care of hospitalized COVID patients.
I neglected to mention in my list that also the cancer history was a part of this, and that was associated with an odds ratio of 4.07. And I have to say that this is also the first time that I've seen an assessment of cancer history as a predictor of poor outcome.
Well, those patients are often immunosuppressed either because of the cancer itself or because of the therapy they're getting. And as we know, most of the patients who die have some comorbidity. Hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and immunosuppression happens to be one of those.
Let's turn to the final one. That's In Nature Medicine, looking at real-time tracking of self-reported symptoms to predict potential COVID-19.
This was a very interesting study. It talks about using a smartphone application to try to predict how many individuals at a particular time are actually infected with COVID virus. And what they did was they evaluated over 2.6 million participants in the United Kingdom and in the United States. The United Kingdom was the test cohort, and the United States was the validation cohort. And they asked them what their symptoms were. And then a small group of those individuals, over 18,000, had actually been tested for the COVID virus. Some were positive and some were negative. So they're able to correlate the symptoms with the positivity or negativity of the test and use that information to predict how many patients were actually infected. When they looked at all the symptoms, they found there were four that were particularly useful in determining whether someone had a positive COVID test. One was severe or significant persistent cough. Second was fatigue. The third was skipped meals. And the fourth is something we've talked about, that is a loss of smell and taste. And by the way, the loss of smell and taste was the most predictive in terms of identifying people that had COVID infection. So when they use all of these variables, what they discovered was the positive and negative predictive value was pretty good. It was 70 to 75%. And based upon this, they estimated that of the number of individuals that were using the application, that about 140,312, or about 17% of their participants, were likely to have a COVID infection.
I think that these things are incredibly useful. And I would say that I'm also seeing a lot of concern about invasion of privacy when it comes to tracking these kinds of things.
This use is a little bit different because the loss of privacy pertains particularly to geolocating individuals. There is some thought that if you can identify who these individuals are and geographically isolate them using their phone, that could help prevent the spread. But you're right, that does present concerns of privacy. This is a smartphone application where people actually enter their symptoms and based upon that, predict the likelihood that they may be COVID infection. It's voluntary, number one. Secondly, it doesn't involve any geographic isolation at all. Obviously, it does involve entering data, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to identify who you are.
Right. And I would counter that with the fact that it is pretty easy to identify who you are based on your smartphone data.
Again, Elizabeth, it's one of the many tools that individuals can use to look at their symptoms. Say, based upon these, what's the likelihood that I may or may not have COVID infection? Because as you're aware, people are hypersensitive. I was visiting with someone this last weekend that developed a rash and said, well, I hear rashes can be caused by COVID. Do I have COVID infection? And that was the only symptom. It ended up being a contact dermatitis and not COVID-related rash. People are hypersensitive. So if there are ways that they can use to identify whether their symptoms, and particularly in the population around them, portends a higher risk of COVID, I think it could be helpful.
And I'm also going to say to you, we're going to hear a lot more about these particular concerns. On that note, let's look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.